just looking around the room to see who all was here, and I see some new faces. There's some new people here. Who here is kind of new to Krishna consciousness? Okay. The other evening, at one of the family's homes, we began a discussion on prayers of Lord Brahma. So, Lord Brahma is the firstborn living being, according to Vedas, different than Adam and Eve. Lord Brahma is born directly from the body of Garbhadakshai Vishnu, according to the what's his name? Stephen Hawkins? That's his name? Recently passed away. The British scientist, genius, personality. So I'm not so familiar, but some of the headlines I saw about his passing is just before his passing, a topic that he was musing about and speaking about was parallel universes, multiple universes, something like that. So he should have read the Vedas because it already said all of that. There's the Vedic picture is there's a lot of universes. There's more universes than you can count, that many. That's like the number of waves in a river. Count the number of waves in a river. It's a challenge. And then as soon as you're done with counting the waves, then there's more waves. There's too many to count. Some finite number, but too many to count. Numbers of universes. And the Vedic picture of time is each universe lasts for the duration of life of the Lord Brahma who is within that universe and creates the universe. And then when that period of time is over, everything, the whole of the cosmic manifestation is withdrawn, and it then enters into a dormant state. The Sanskrit term is avyakta. Creation is vyakta. The elements aren't temporary. The elements are eternal because they're one of Krishna's unlimited energies. Eternal. Material nature is eternal. But creation is temporary, influenced by time. And when that time period, dviprarardhas, is over, a big number, lots of zeros at the end. Cosmic annihilation takes place, and the elements go back into their elemental, undifferentiated state. Big warehouse all jumbled up of all the different elements, called pradhan. And then, for equal duration, there's the cosmic annihilation. And then, in cyclical time, it's time for creation again, and the universes are released. There's a detailed description of that process. And the universes begin as a seed, the word is used, bija, and the elements that have now differentiated because of contact with the Supreme Lord's glancing upon them, very powerful eyes, he impregnates with his eyes, and the universes come expanding from his body, and the elements cling or conglomerate around that seed, and like impregnation, the body starts to grow, the body of the universe. And then within the body of the universe, within the body of the universe, there's this hollow area. It's like a coconut, it's compared. It has a shell, and half inside the shell of the coconut, there's coconut water. So the universe is compared like that. It has a covering. Garbhadakshay Vishnu enters within each universe of the so many, 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 too many to count universes. And he lies down in this water, the Garbhadak ocean, and because it's still time for creation, the total karma, we all know what karma is. Karma is the actions and reactions of all the living entities. So there's many details, but a universe's worth of living entities have come with Garbhadakshay Vishnu. They are within his body. Their karma becomes activated by time, because you need time to have karma fulfilled. Karma becomes activated, and that full karma of all the living entities within one universe expands from his body in the form of a stem of a lotus. Then on top of that stem comes one of those living entities given the name Lord Brahma, and he undergoes some tapa, some austerity of meditating upon the mantra which he hears, and he becomes enlightened. He becomes fully acquainted with the ocean of truth in the language of Brahma Samhita, and then he speaks wonderful prayers. This is even before creation begins, Brahma Samhita. And then he gets instruction from his father, Lord Vishnu, how to undergo the process of creation. So it's the sub-creation, because the main creation is already done. The ingredients, the plan, the blueprint, all the architectural design and all the engineering and everything's done. And there's all the ingredients, and there's the ability, and now begin. And so he begins the sub-creation, this sarga, and then fills up the universe that he creates with living entities. And it's this detailed process of how creation unfolds is found within the Bhagavatam. And then the Vedas give this picture that from time to time, just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, yada yada hi dharma shaglani. Glani means discrepancy. When there's discrepancy in dharma, because at the beginning of creation, we know from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, from the very beginning of creation, Krishna sends the Vedic process of sacrifice, of how to take this place, creation, and offer it to Vishnu, and render this place sacred by the act of sacrifice. That's the purpose of creation, to restore the consciousness of the karma bondaged living entities to become free from karma. That knowledge is given from the very beginning. And when there's discrepancy amongst the living beings in the execution of Dharma, Krishna appears, Srijamyaham, Srijami Aham. Aham is first person singular, Krishna, Srijami, he manifests himself. Yuge, yuge, from time to time, different ages of mankind. So the path, when Krishna makes his appearances, there's different features of Krishna, because he's unlimited also. And when he appears particularly in the case of Krishna, he appears and performs his wonderful pastimes in Vrindavan. His wonderful pastimes in Vrindavan are the same pastimes as are performed in the spiritual world. Very lovely. We get a chance, even we're in this material world, to know what the spiritual world is like when Krishna comes and performs his pastimes of the spiritual world. Really wonderful. So these prayers that we heard the other evening are an occasion when Krishna has appeared in this world, and Brahma, who's well acquainted with the ocean of truth, he knows Krishna Tattva. We're doing a little logistic thing here. Those that are in the back, more people will come in so that there's room. If you could all come forward a little bit. One of our Sunday rituals. Those people that have the wall space, it's sacred, you don't have to move. Brahma knew that the Supreme Lord of the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan, has expanded himself and he's performing his pastimes in Vrindavan. Let's go see. So he went, because he has that power. And when he came to Vrindavan, he saw something that was really amazing. He saw a pastime of Krishna where a demon sent by Kamsa, who had mystic power and could assume different forms, assumed the form of a humongous serpent, huge. His upper jaw, when his jaw was open, was touching the clouds. It looked like this giant cave. But it was a demon, Agasura, who wanted to kill Krishna. So it worked the other way around. Krishna showed his mystic power after entering into the mouth of Agasura, and Lagima Mahima Siddhi became bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and the body of the serpent expanded and expanded, but Krishna expanded faster. And the life force of the serpent was forced out of his serpent body, right out of the top of his head. Krishna left the mouth of the Agasura demon. The soul of that Agasura demon hovered like a light in the sky, and then merged into the body of Krishna. And the cowherd boys said, "Wow, that was good. Let's go have lunch." So they were sitting having lunch. And Brahma watched all this amazing pastime and started wondering, what is the limit of Krishna's mystic power? There is no limit. But what is the limit? And so, in that curiosity mood, he tested his mystic power against Krishna's mystic power to see what Krishna would do. So there's details, but he then kidnapped the calves and the cowherd boys. There's detail of how that transpired. And then he went back to see, what's Krishna going to do now? Is he going to cry? Is he going to turn to me and say, oh, Brahma, please help, the cowherd boys and calves are gone? Because he's a little boy. Just a little boy. So when he went back, he was amazed because he saw all the calves and all the cowherd boys, and he had just kidnapped them and put them in a cave. So when he went back to the cave, and there were the calves and the cowherd boys in the cave. And he went back to the scene of the crime, and there were the calves and the cowherd boys. He was astonished. And then all of a sudden, while maintaining their calf and cowherd boy forms, simultaneously for each one, forms of Narayana. The cowherd boy form and Narayana form. And surrounding Narayana were all the various demigods and sages, the Vedas personified, a big cacophony of sound as they were vibrating hymns and glorification of Lord Narayana. And all the potencies, their names are given. How many potencies does God have? Unlimited. And there they were, worshipping the Supreme Lord. Big, tumultuous sound, big concert. Loud. No amplification needed. It was really loud. And then suddenly, poof, everything disappeared. Because that means Krishna withdrew those potencies. And then all that was left was what you see here, Krishna, beneath a tree. In his left hand was a lump of yogurt and some fruit. And in his right hand, eating the fruit and yogurt, smiling at Brahma. So Brahma offered prayers, and that's the circumstance. That's what we heard on the other evening. The first prayers, we've heard 1 through 8, they're simply glorifications, because Brahma is highly learned, the language is exalted as well. And he's extolling the virtue of devotion, saying essentially, other means of trying to understand you, I'm honored as being most learned. But it's not by knowledge that one can understand you. Very famous verse, Jnane Prayasa Udapasya Namanta Eva. We discussed that verse in the other 7 verses. But amongst them, that's especially well known because it's describing the essence of the goal of life and how to achieve it. We know that because Lord Chaitanya honored that verse in a discussion with Ramananda Roy when he asked the question, what's the goal of life? And the means to achieve it. And he rejected many other scriptural references and accepted this one. Stane sitak shruti gatam tanavan manobir. Stay in your position, whatever you may be. A householder, a student, a this or that. Whatever your, the external is not the consideration. Stay in your, whatever is your nature, stay according to your nature. be guided by theistic conduct, by the codes of Dharma, as you're doing those things that are of your nature to do, do them in that way. And within that chamber, incubation chamber, you should hear Shruti Katam Tanavan Manobir. You should hear the topics of transcendence found within the Vedas. Let it enter your ear, let it enter your heart, let it enter your being, and live your life according to that. And if you simply live jiveta, you live in that consciousness of your relationship with Krishna, you'll go back to Godhead. It's an important verse. There's different elements of that important verse. But it's instructive. Similar to Bhagavad Gita's message to Arjuna, Krishna's advice to Arjuna was not, okay, Arjuna, you want to know what your duty is. You should stop being a warrior and become a peaceful man and, you know, abide by something that's not your nature and just, like, elevate your nature and do something better and cleaner. He didn't say that. Stay in your position as a soldier, a warrior. That's a service that you can do for me too. Stay in your position as a householder. That's fine. You don't have to become a renunciate or a monk. You just stay as a householder. Arjuna had several wives. And Krishna, the speaker of Bhagavad Gita, had more than several wives. So it's not that you have to give up family life and occupation and worldly duties. You do those things as an offering unto Krishna, this act of sacrifice to the Supreme. Do that. That's recommended. So he's made his initial prayers glorifying the bhakti process to render this place, the created realm, as suitable offerings to the Supreme through the bhakti process. In that way, one can get some understanding of Krishna. And now we're going to hear five more verses, just five. All that was just review of the other evening. My Lord, just see my uncivilized impudence to test your power. I tried to extend my illusory potency to cover you, the unlimited and primeval super soul, who bewildered even the masters of illusion. What am I compared to you? Just like a small spark in the presence of a great fire. I put color along with the Sanskrit words and their translation in English so we can get a sense of the meaning, because the Sanskrit language is very precise and very elevated. But it's expressions of humility, and appropriately so, because he just made a big, not just a mistake, he made a big offense. He went and it not only interrupted Krishna's pastimes, but he kidnapped the calves and the cowherd boys. That's a no-no. And he did it. And he did it with, as he's calling it, impudence. He did it with, this word here is arya. And it's anarya, uncivilized. In Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1, Krishna uses this word arya with Arjuna. He says to Arjuna, anarya jushtam ashvargyam. How is this non-Aryan?
How has this non-Aryan arrogant behavior overcome you. Because there, and that's what the Prabhupada said. Arrogant.
I saw it blow up.
Arrogant.
Huh? I actually saw it.
Is one who knows the impressive value of his life. Just fix it without mumbling. Oh, I'll speak louder. Aryan, like in Nazi Germany, the Germans, they also read Vedas, and one of the marks that marks the Nazi doctrine is the swastika, comes from Vedas. He studied the Vedas. He just, like, was a disturbed man and twisted the Vedas and took it in his own way. But there was appreciation for the knowledge within the Vedas. That mark, or the mark of an Aryan, is one who knows the higher values of life. And the higher values of life are using our human existence to achieve perfect consciousness, or higher consciousness, or consciousness of the source of everything, the supreme source of everything, is connect with God. So I was behaving, Arjuna, excuse me, Brahma is saying, in this non-Aryan way. And what was that? He was challenging God, challenging Krishna. I've got my power, which comes from Krishna. But when you're forgetful of God, you don't remember that. Whatever you have comes from the source of everything. So I was using my power and testing it against your power. And your power is unlimited. And so I have some power of illusion in others, but you really showed me who's the master of illusion.
This is a little illustration that I like to use. The spirit of inquisitiveness. We were discussing this the other evening. Not the same evening as we were discussing this past time, but the spirit of I want to know, I think a very safe assumption, is everybody that's here, inclusively, accepts there's a higher reality. There's something more than the cosmetic externals of life. And you take away all those externals, strip it down, and what's left? What's sat? What's eternal? What's truth with a capital T? Or reality with a capital R? What's that? And wanting to know that is inquisitiveness. Jigyasu in Sanskrit language. Jigyasu, I want to know. So Brahma wanted to know the limit of the unlimited. And his realization from those first eight prayers is you can't know that by speculative process. The only way to know the unlimited is through devotion. Because then through devotion the unlimited discloses. That's how you can know. So the inquisitive spirit is, with humility, is in this prayer that we just covered. So there's Brahma and his swan carrier. It looks a little small. And Lord Krishna standing beneath a tree. The next verse. Therefore, O infallible Lord, kindly excuse my offenses. I have taken birth in the mode of passion and am therefore simply foolish, presuming myself a controller independent of your lordship. My eyes are blinded by the darkness of ignorance, which caused me to think of myself as an unborn creator of the universe. But please consider that I am your servant and therefore worthy of your compassion. Your servant, Natavan. Nata means master or lord, like Jagannath or Natadwar. Nata means lord. Jagannath is lord of the universe. So here's Natavan, one who has a master or the servant. And Anukampyo Mayi. Anukampa. We're going to hear some more as we go along with his prayers about mercy or compassion. In this world, we have a capacity for compassion because that capacity exists in its fullness within the Supreme. So if we can exhibit compassion upon others, at least when motive goodness is more prominent and prevalent, then compassion becomes stronger. But it's there because it's existing within the Supreme and unlimited. So he's appealing, this is an important bhakti principle, he was endeavoring in some way to understand, but we can't understand without the reciprocation of mercy and compassion. In making any endeavor in this world, whatever it may be, we need to make some effort, and we need God's mercy. And those that don't think they need God's mercy, that's called atheism. And they don't place themselves in the mood of serving the Supreme. But then a life of devotion teaches, whatever you do, some effort is needed. And we need to recognize, we do recognize, that we're dependent upon the mercy of the Supreme to achieve anything. To do your duties. When we're done, we'll get up and walk across the floor and go over and take prasadam. To do that takes some empowerment by Krishna. We have legs, but if the power of locomotion is taken away, you're immobilized. To breathe. I had this episode one time when it was difficult to breathe, and you kind of take breathing for granted, but when you can't breathe, you know, you're dependent. To digest, etc., to blink your eyelid, to digest your food, to do anything, this thing that we take for granted, their abilities are given to us by God that can be taken just like that. The whole shebang is taken just like that. We're dependent. It's a fact, it's not imagination. We're dependent. And a life of devotion is one recognizes that fact. So I'm endeavoring to do something. I'm endeavoring to be a good citizen or a good student or a good mother or a good father or good whatever it is, a good cook, a good anything. I'm dependent. Recognizing that dependence, let me place my effort in the gesture of sacrifice to the Supreme, unto the Supreme, and accept the mercy, appeal for the mercy of the Supreme, so that my endeavor can be pleasing to the Supreme. And that's the standard of success. Not just what you cook comes out tasting good. Then burn it and spiced it nicely and people say, yummy. That's not the success. The success is Krishna is pleased. That's the success. For a life of devotion. But he wants that. He wants the compassion of Krishna. He's already done big time service. He created a universe. Who can do that? And then he filled up the universe with qualified living entities. Who can do that? And he's the head of all the controllers of the universe. Who can do that? He's done lots of fantastic service. But he, you know, his life doesn't rest upon the fantastic service that he's done. He wants to continue in that mood with humility and dependence upon the Supreme, receiving the mercy of the Supreme. Anukampam susamikshamano. What am I? Here's another. It's the same verse again. Here's the calves and the cowherd boys, and Brahma is speaking to Krishna. What am I, a small creature measuring seven spans of my own hand? I am enclosed in a pot-like universe composed of material nature, the total material energy, false ego, ether, air, water, and earth. And what is your glory? Unlimited universes pass through the pores of your body, just as particles of dust pass through the openings of a screened window, which means even during Brahma's time they had screens. Not a new invention. But we probably, you know, somewhere along the way as children or something, sat by a window and saw little particles of dust dancing in the air. And his example is passing through the screen, openings of a screen. How great is Krishna that universes, seeds of universes, his body is so big, Vishnu, that universes are streaming through the pores of his body, just like particles of dust coming through the holes of a screen. And who am I? Who am I? Little insignificant speck within the universe, within one of those universes, one of those particles of dust that come through is the body of Mahavishnu. I may be the creator of what's inside, but I'm just a tiny spark. So, and who are you? And I'm testing you. I'm challenging you. Oh Lord of Hoksaja, does a mother take offense when the child within her womb kicks with his legs? And is there anything in existence, whether designated by various philosophers as real or as unreal, that is actually outside of your abdomen? Again, there's Lord Brahma, who came on his swan carrier, looked like a albino hen, not a swan. And here he is paying his obeisances at the feet of Krishna. It's an old style painting. So in the depiction of creation, Mahavishnu, at the time of cosmic annihilation, go a little slower. For creation, you need certain things, and one of them is time. Time exists in the spiritual world in its form of the absence of past, present, and future. Or time is eternal. Say it a different way. Time as we know it is absent. Time is conspicuous by its absence in the spiritual world. But time as we know it is absent. But there is eternal time. Sat. Eternal existence in the spiritual realm. And for the purpose of creation, time is needed. So when it's time for creation, Mahavishnu glances over material nature, pradhan, undifferentiated totality of the material elements, and his glance is then entrusted with the living entities that were in his body, and time energy. The person who does that is Rama Devi, the internal potency of Vishnu. She knows her master's will. He wants the living entities to have an opportunity to perfect themselves. So she assists him by taking all the living entities within his abdomen and the time energy and entrusting that to Pradhan. So during cosmic annihilation, very simple. You pull the plug. He withdraws time. And when time energy is withdrawn, the whole thing collapses like a balloon. Like people have these Christmas decorations outside their home and they pump it up with some air and there's Santa Claus or something. And then at night they let the air out. There's this Santa Claus collapsed on the ground. So the Prakriti, material nature, without time energy, it goes back to this undifferentiated state. And when the time energy is released, it gets pumped up again with living entities and time, and then karma becomes activated and so forth. And then time as we know it, past, present, and future kind of time. But all of that is potencies within his abdomen. So he's saying, what is there that's not? And does the mother scold the child in the womb, stop kicking? It may not be comfortable, but she doesn't scold the child. And so, please forgive me. And for that matter, whatever philosophers may say is real or unreal, is there any of that real or unreal that's outside of you? Here's the verse again. The final verse for this section. O Lord Adhokshaja. Oops, same one. Okay. That's the conclusion. What happened? Okay. So those are a series of verses from Lord Brahma's prayers. Shortly, I'll say one of them, one coming attraction, I guess. He wants forgiveness, but he knows because of his wrong deed, he's going to get spanked. He's going to get the reaction for his wrong deeds. And his prayer to Krishna is a very wonderful and very important prayer for devotees. Whatever the reaction that's due to me for my past misdeeds, let that come. Because he could pray, you know, please give me a lighter penalty. He doesn't. Whatever you feel is appropriate, that's just for my mistake, my wrongdoing, my offense, I accept it, whatever your plan is. And there's only one thing that I'm going to fix my consciousness upon, and that is whatever the circumstance of life that comes my way, let me just fix my consciousness at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Actually, that's in this previous verse. Tat tenu kampam su samikshamano. Let me not let my mind budge an inch from your lotus feet, because by doing that, I know that the destination of going back to Godhead will come. If our external circumstances, good fortune or ill fortune, it seems that it's going very nicely, or it seems like it's fraught with trouble. When those fraught with trouble times come, commonly our consciousness gets absorbed in the trouble. Not where we're going long term, but just reducing the trouble. We become preoccupied with the circumstance that's right in our face or right before us. And then the next one comes, the next one comes, the next one comes, and maybe more difficult, less difficult, but we get absorbed in the temporary and not in the, you know, the greater destination of the mission of life. And Brahma's teaching, let the temporary good fortune, ill fortune come and go, and let my mind not move one inch from the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Now, how each of us, we want to be happy without exception. It's just not the nature of the soul. Nothing wrong with wanting to be happy. It's good. It's good to want to be happy. It's our nature. And wanting to be happy independent of the Supreme Lord, that's where the problem is. Desire is not the problem. Ignorance is the problem. Independent happiness is ignorance because it doesn't exist. It's illusion. And so then we're captured by the force of illusion or Maya. So bhakti teaches to go beyond ignorance and connect with knowledge. Connect with knowledge of our actual position. We're very tiny and we're dependent upon the Supreme. Let us act in that consciousness always. And then the good fortune, ill fortune, we may deal with it, but it's not the absorption of our consciousness. The absorption of our consciousness is our relationship with the Supreme. I'm just going to end with something that's non-Vedic. Maybe I shouldn't, but it illustrates the point. From time to time, when I engage in public speaking, particularly in corporate sectors, something they're very interested in is stress management. So the first time I was asked to teach stress management, I agreed on one principle. I have to speak from my own voice, so I'd like to speak from the voice of the spiritual perspective of stress management. And they say, sure. They didn't know what they were in for. And so I start by saying, you know, the best stress management is to not have any. And that's called Vaikuntha. A consciousness where there's no anxiety, no stress. That's the best. But now we're down here, so we have the picture of what's best, and let's understand how to manage stress. Because remember, it's due to forgetfulness of that position where there's no stress. Our existence in Vaikuntha. So one of the messages is the Chinese farmer story. And it's real simple. And it goes like this. Once upon a time, there was a Chinese farmer. And in the village where he lived, the other farmers in the village considered him to be very fortunate because he had a horse. And they came to him and said, our dear friend, you have great fortune, you have a horse, because we have to plow our fields by hand, but you have a horse and you can plow your fields so much more easily. So you have such good fortune. And the Chinese farmer was a Taoist. He said, good fortune, ill fortune, who can say? Very detached. After some time, the horse ran away. And the village people came and said, oh, what misfortune, your horse ran away, now you have to plow your fields like the rest of us. And his reply was, good fortune, ill fortune, who can say? Some time passed, the horse came back. And when the horse came back with some other wild horses. So the villagers came to the farmer and said, oh, what good fortune, now you have many horses, you can plow your fields much more easily, because now you have many horses instead of just one. And his reply was the same. Good fortune, ill fortune, who can say? His son was trying to train the wild horses to plow the field, and he fell off one of the wild horses and broke his leg. So then the villagers came to the farmer and said, oh, what misfortune, your son broke his leg. And now you can't, you know, take advantage of all these extra horses to plow your field. And his reply was, good fortune, ill fortune, who can say? And then the Chinese government went to war. It's right on Wiki. You'll find the story. Not my story. And so the government came, all able-bodied men within a certain range of age has to join the army and go off and fight the war. So when they came to the village, the son had a broken leg, so he didn't have to go off to war. So the villagers came to the farmer and said, oh, what good fortune, your son didn't have to go off to war because he had a broken leg. And the farmer said, good fortune, ill fortune, who can say? Now, that's the end of the story. So he was not attached to either the apparent good fortune or apparent ill fortune because he was a Taoist. Doesn't say that in the story, but I just know what Taoism perspective is. You kind of go with the flow, whatever it is, que sera, sera. And for a devotee, there's detachment from the temporary with a higher purpose, the purpose of attachment to the supreme. That's bhakti. And with attachment to the supreme, not like you don't care what happens around you, but it doesn't determine your happiness or distress. You deal with it in an appropriate manner, in a responsible manner, and wait a while, the picture's going to change, and it'll be something else. And wait a while, that picture's going to change, it'll be something else. And so there's this kaleidoscope of different opportunities of service that come into our lives according to guna and karma, the modes of nature and our past activity, and here it comes. You're walking along the path of life, thinking, you know, whatever you're thinking, and here comes the new set of circumstances. And life just keeps moving like that. So the devotee, in a responsible manner of service, according to theistic conduct, addresses those circumstances of life. And at the same time, keeps their consciousness fixed in the lotus feet of Krishna. That means in the mood of being his servant. Whatever the circumstance may be, always in the mood of being the insignificant, humble servant of the Master Krishna. And that consciousness carries one to the spiritual world. Purnar Janma Navidyate. The cycle of birth and death is broken or stopped, interrupted. Samsara becomes returned to the spiritual realm by spiritual consciousness. So that's something we cultivate in this life. And as we cultivate, like a seed, you cultivate the seed and it matures. We heard that the other evening. This gardening metaphor of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Lord Brahma is expressing that in his nice prayers to Krishna. And there's more to come, but another visit will continue. The nice prayers of Lord Brahma. Any discussion or questions you'd like to raise? Yes?
Three-part question. Why does Lord Brahma have four heads? Is his carrier really a swan? Because in one of the purports, Prabhupada says it's actually a spaceship. And we know that Lord Brahma from the Bhagavatam is one of the progenitors of all the living entities. Does the Bhagavatam tell us about the process of differentiation of the human species into different groups? Because I know it says that we're all one species.
No. We'll start with that one. We're all one species.
Well, you know,
8,400,000 over and over and over, Prabhupada would recite.
You know what I mean is, like, you have many species of birds. You don't have many species of human beings.
Oh, yes, you do. 400,000. 400,000. This is a smaller number than birds, but it's 400,000. Now, I heard twice recordings of Prabhupada, devotees pressing Prabhupada. Can you expand on that, the 400,000? Like, what does it mean? And he wouldn't open his hand up. You know, is it all on this planet, or is it some other planets in the universes? And, you know, can you give some examples, Prabhupada, of the 400,000? And he wouldn't do that. But 400,000. In the human species, in that category, 400,000 divisions. Like, you know, you can say that for birds, there's Latin names and, you know, characteristics of different species. Those are the ones that are known. Anyway, so the science has that down to some extent. It's not a one-to-one correlation with the Vedic perspective of species necessarily. But there's a number, a finite number, which is your point. Same for human. There's 400,000.
So within that 400,000, we can all mate?
We can all do what?
They can mate with one another.
I don't know about that. There may be some in the heavenly planets. How are you going to mate with somebody in the heavenly planets? I don't know. Because, you know, you're taking it to the next step, and I can't go to the next step without knowing this step. And probably, you know, descending knowledge doesn't fill that information in, so I can't answer your question other than saying there's 400,000. And you're asking, you know, what about what happens after that? I don't know what those 400,000 are. Can't say. Possibly. You know, can a bird from this species mate with a bird from that species? You know, I have to ask a geneticist, I guess. Why does Brahma have four heads? I've never heard that question before. As you know, because you've read Prabhupada's books, apparently, in different universes, there are Brahmas that have different heads, different numbers of heads. Mm-hmm. And ours is the smallest of the universes, according to the Vedic picture of relative sizes of universes. And so our Brahma has the smallest number of heads, four. And it is said that when his inquisitive spirit awakened, from the time he was born, he was by nature inquisitive, and he inquired, he looked in all four directions. Where have I come from? And so, not like he only had one until he looked in four directions, but he manifested four heads, looking in the four directions, searching, who am I? Where have I come from? But plan of the Supreme Lord would be my answer. Why four? Why 10? Why 100? Why 10,000? Plan of the Supreme Lord. the middle question?
His carrier.
So, using that language, you know, a spaceship, why Prabhupada would use that language when consistently in the Vedic text, it's a swan? I take a guess. It's not an item of knowledge in response, but he's speaking to an audience that doesn't understand swan carriers. So he uses a language that's more, you know, sensible to them, more relatable to them. A spaceship to move from this part to that part of the universe in a spaceship. But it's a swan. It's the, obviously not a normal swan, just like the Nandi, the carrier of Lord Shiva, is not an ordinary bull. Ravana found that out. And etc. So not ordinary. But for persons that can't relate to the beyond ordinary, this other language is being used. Okay. Bill. No, let's go back here. Okay.
Hare Krishna, Mahabhagavad, how are you?
I don't know.
I want to ask a question in relation to stress. You were talking about corporate America and just basic America, period, because everyone's dealing with a lot of stress, a lot.
Okay, keep your question simple, if you would.
Yeah, it's very simple and fundamental. In relation to stress, and you talked about Vaikuntha and anxieties, and one being, you know what I'm saying, devoid of anxieties. I want to bring in the element of the Maha Mantra, Krishna, chanting the name of Krishna, and its effect as far as alleviating those anxieties and stabilizing one in a neutral platform of peace and stress-free energy just by chanting that name itself. Is that possible? Can one chant the name of Krishna incessantly and achieve a peaceful state, a stress-free state?
Okay, pass the microphone back before I give an answer. Pass it over to Bill. Yeah, but more than stress-free, because the potency of Krishna's name includes everything, because Krishna and his name are non-different. So the potency takes one beyond just the stress-free state to the liberated state of loving service. So that's the, you know, the state of ecstasy. State of ecstasy is beyond stress-free, beyond neutrality.
Hey, Hare Krishna. The question I have is about Brahma. Now, the one in our universe is four heads. Would the universe that has 64 heads, Brahma, would that necessarily make it 16 times the size of our universe?
Is it a
proportion like that?
I don't know. Okay. Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. It doesn't say, so I can't say something. How do I know about all these things? Except the scripture says, and our acharyas explain, and that's how we know something that's beyond the purview of this little tiny brain. So you're asking a reasonable question, and my answer is I don't know anything within the statement of the Bhagavatam or the Vedas or our acharyas that explains and gives the answer to your question, yes or no. Maybe. Mm-hmm. We don't know.
But the more heads, the larger the universe.
Well, that's logically, yes. But, you know, we don't know. Logically. But, you know, proportionally that many times, I don't know. 16 times bigger, maybe. Maybe. Maybe not. Sounds reasonable. But we still don't know. the logic and reason that that's Brahma's jnane prayasa udapashyanam. Prayasa means endeavor. Jnane prayasa udapashyanamante. So set aside this effort of trying to understand that which is beyond one's capacity to know by speculative knowledge efforts. That's his prayer. He has done that, and you know, following him, we should also. I don't think there's anything wrong with your question. It's just we don't know. And so we just leave it at that. We don't know. Unless there's some descending knowledge coming, we know what we know because it's coming from this perfect source. And if the perfect source doesn't disclose that particular piece of information. Yes, larger universes. How much larger? Who can say? Anything else? Yeah. Let's go over here and then over there and then... No, behind you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my most humble obeisances.
Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, one question. You were talking about the why when we commit offenses or mistakes. So while practicing Krishna consciousness also, sometimes we commit some mistakes or offenses.
Yeah.
So and then we pray to the Supreme Lord that, oh my dear Lord, whatever I have committed, the sinful activities, please make me, this is my consciousness, Maharaj. So make me free from the whatever I committed, the offenses on. So this prayers is a, like as a good devotee, this is a good consciousness while praying to the Supreme Lord, or we should pray that, my dear Lord, whatever I have committed, the offenses, I am ready for the consequences that. That's so please. So this one is the best consciousness, right? So, which one is the best consciousness? So, please make me free from that one, or whatever I have committed the offenses, I am, oh my dear Lord, I am okay for these consequences, but please keep me in your service. So, which one is the best?
Your question is, which is preferred?
Yeah, which is preferred as a good devotee?
Well, they're both good. They're both good. The critical point is what happens afterwards. Whether one appeals for, you know, forgiveness for the offense, or let the reaction from my misdeed come, I'm ready. What's most important is what comes after that. Let me immerse myself in your loving service in a favorable, proper way. Because that has the power to relieve one of reactions of past misdeeds. That in itself, bhakti has the power to completely incinerate any reactions to past misdeeds. Bhakti has that power. So the real, please keep me engaged in your service. So whether it's A or B, preliminary about the past, let me be fully absorbed going into the future. That's my appeal. And so, either A or B. One of the things with the B, please relieve me of the reactions, is about me. It's not about Krishna. I'm still me-centered. But let me be engaged in your service is not utilitarian. I want to get rid of those reactions, so please engage me in your service. I want to be engaged in your service.
In B case, we are not ready to for the consequences because we want to free from the reaction.
It's self-centered. Now, there's some things, at least for the duration of this life, there's nothing one can do about it. I know some people, for example, some persons that have some chronic health, without going into details, and it's just going to be with them for the rest of their life. You know, they don't need to pray, please, you know, take my life, or please take away this thing that's not going to be taken away. I accept it. For this lifetime, it's just going to be with me. I accept it. And supposing there are some things that can be improved. One can, akama, sarva kamova, moksha kama, udaradi. Udaradi means broad intelligence, di. Udaradi. Those who have broad intelligence, tivrena bhakti yogena. That's on the other side. So even if it's sarva kama, you know, I want to get free from the reaction of this past misdeed. My desire is at the center, not. There's this nice instructive prayer, Prithu Maharaj, Prithu, when he's being crowned as the emperor. Lord Shiva comes, Lord Vishnu comes, Narada Muni comes, they're all to honor him at this event. And Prithu offers a prayer to Lord Vishnu. You've come to offer a benediction. I'm like a child. And the father knows best what's best for the child. So I'm not going to ask you for anything. If you feel it beneficial for me to have something, whatever you like. No, you know, it's not the benediction. I've got some past misdeeds, and could you make the sentence lighter, please? Or whatever. So that's a nice position. Whatever, you're the well-wishing master. You know what's best. I want to accept that. Say yes to Krishna is our little phrase. Say yes to Krishna. Another question over here.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Bol.
I was wondering, first, is there a supposed to be another advent of Lord Krishna, or
do we,
like another advent, another manifestation on earth?
Another manifestation of Krishna on earth?
Mm-hmm.
Well, from according to the Vedic picture, from time to time, yes. Mm. Yada yada hi dharma shav. So from time to time he comes, or various expansions of him come. From time to time. The next one that's scheduled to come is Kalki. You heard of Kalki? He comes at the end of the age of Kali, when all that is good is practically destroyed. People become, you know, really bad. Very, very, very unfortunate. And he comes. He gives the name of a family, etc., etc. And he comes riding a white horse, has a big sword, and he liberates everybody. He chops people with his big sword. And the souls get freed, liberated. And it's the bottom of the age of Kali, and then Satyayuga starts again. It's really far out. Here's an image I like. Imagine a big vat of paint that's white. You take an eyedropper of red and blue and squeeze an eyedropper's worth of red and blue into the white and keep stirring it. It becomes off-white. And then by karma, the red, the passion, and the ignorance have a reaction. It gets darker and darker and darker and darker and darker. And it's like a whirlpool where if you place an object in the outer perimeter of the whirlpool and it starts moving slowly around and around, then it goes towards the middle and then it goes faster and faster and then down. That's the age of Kali. Now how do you get from Kali to sattva, to a mode of goodness? Kalki. Kalki comes and just wipes everything out, liberates the souls, and then satya can start again. That's how it works. It goes back to goodness. After all this darkness, like, you know, the bucket of white paint again. All the reactions of all the sinful living entities completely eliminated, souls purified. That's the next one coming. Kalki. So if somebody, you know, says something else, I'm God or he's God or something like that, it's interesting, but it's not supported by...
Can't Krishna descend whenever and wherever?
How'd you get the microphone?
Mystic potency. But can't Krishna descend whenever and wherever?
Yeah, there's a decline in religion.
Whenever there's a decline in religion. Okay, thank you.
Okay. There's some of the mystics in the audience out there. Did you have a second question, or you were done?
I wanted to understand.
Go ahead, speak. You don't need one.
You said if someone had a chronic illness.
Yeah.
So the next thing I want to know is, could we depend upon Krishna for healing?
Yes.
Or other things that we may need in this life?
Sure. Whatever. You go to Krishna with it, just like a child. A dependent child. What does a dependent child do? That's what a dependent child does. So we do that. Now, it's not that mother or father, they'll certainly pick up the child, but they're not necessarily, if the child is coughing, they touch them and they don't cough anymore. Or they got a pain and the pain goes away or something. But, you know, so we go to Krishna for shelter. And within the Vedas, there's Ayurveda, and you go to a doctor for the cure of some illness, and that's part of Krishna's, you know, embrace. His kindness is, there's a way to bring balance again to the bodily system. But in some cases, I'm aware of some cases where the alignment of the doshas within the body isn't getting to its proper place again, and so cure doesn't happen, even within the purview of medical science given by Krishna. So one has to accept. You make effort and you depend on mercy, and you depend on mercy in the proper way, the mode of goodness way. That's best. And we depend on Krishna. And so in some cases you just accept, I'm going to only have one leg to work with. Or whatever it is. Whatever it is. Just, you know, may get prosthesis, but I've got, you know, just one leg. That's it. Okay? We turn to God for chronic illness. We also accept whatever dispensation comes in this descending fashion. Okay, I'm going to end there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.